We had 1 week kind of introduction last week, so we talked about authorship, and then one of the primary words or themes throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, which is hevel, often translated vanity. And we sort of talked through the various meanings that that could be. What could this hevel mean? What is Qohelet, the author of Ecclesiastes, seeking to communicate? What's his purpose in writing? And so we kind of eliminated two of these options, that it did not mean vanity or meaningless, that it didn't mean that life has no purpose, even if you can't understand it. Even unsaved people, even those who don't believe in God, still have been given by God inherent value. Their life has inherent value because he's given it to them. And someone may say, well, yes, but the idea is that its value is only within God. Or you only have value in life if you have God present, if he's there, if you're interacting with him, if you fear him. And there's a point to that that's true. However, without God, there is no life anyways. So you don't have something to be valued or not valued without God present. So, and aside from those things, it doesn't seem to be primarily what Qohelet is getting at anyways. It's not the punch of his argument. So then we discussed that it could be and is at some points throughout the book temporary, fleeting. The very literal wooden definition of the word is smoke, right? And the idea of smoke, one of the primary characteristics of it is that it's here and gone very quickly. It doesn't last long at all. And Qohelet uses that several times, particularly with various poems and statements that he makes about the cyclicity of life, that generation after generation continues to pass, that your youth and even the entirety of your life just happens very quickly. So that's definitely one meaning, but we think it's a secondary meaning because the primary meaning throughout the book is enigma. It's a paradox. It's confusing. It's a mystery. It's frustrating. You have things that don't make sense in life. So really, that's the primary thing that Qohelet is wrestling with is what do you do, how do you live when life is broken, when it doesn't make sense, when life under the sun is no longer straight, but it's crooked. And then one other one that we looked at as a possibility was absurdity or iniquity. And we wanted to draw one positive thing out of that, well, yes, it's true that the enigma is not morally neutral, but it is negative, right? There is something bad about it. You recognize that it is broken. However, this absurdity, iniquity, especially the commentator that articulates that, goes way overboard on that side of things and essentially says that, so the whole purpose of this brokenness is to cause fear in us, because the primary thing that Qohelet says, the primary emotion he asks us to respond with, is fear. And he takes that as very literal, like terror, rather than how we're going to understand fear later on. So temporary, fleeting, and mysterious, frustrating, an enigma. Okay, so that was kind of the definition of hevel. And then we wanted to look briefly again at how the wisdom literature is working together. Because you have something like Proverbs that says, fear the Lord, depart from evil, and this will happen. It will be health to your bones. Or honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase, and then your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. Okay, so this is all the time throughout Proverbs, right? This is how Proverbs speaks. If you do this, or this is a characteristic that's true of you, then this is the natural result. If this is a characteristic that's true of you, then this is the natural result. So it's almost, if you were to read it without remembering that the name of the book is Proverbs, and not thinking of what a proverb is, that this is a generally true statement. This is something that tends to happen. It's not, like we said last week, it's not the book of promises, because if it was, then life under the sun would destroy the book of promises, right? So it's the book of Proverbs. So we need to read it this way. So if Proverbs says things like this, fear the Lord, depart from evil, it will be health to your bones. I mean, we all want strong, healthy bones and we want full barns. And I mean, this is great. This is an abundance. This is the way we want to live. So all we need to do is fear the Lord, depart from evil, honor the Lord with our possessions, and then all these good things happen to us. Well, proverbially, yes. Generally, yes. But Ecclesiastes comes into Proverbs and it says, but not always. Because you look around and you see life and you see it's not that clear cut. It's not that black and white. There's gray area here, and something in this perfect system of Proverbs, this kind of like, if we were in utopia, this would be true, right? If we were before, if we had no curse, if there was no brokenness, there was no sin, then that would be true all the time. But it's not. So we live in this broken world that Ecclesiastes addresses. And one of the things that I love about Ecclesiastes is he asks questions that people accuse Christians of not asking. Like, so many people would go into like to universities, right? And the universities perhaps that are liberal and opposed to truth and think that something like this would be absurd. And they'll say, yeah, but look, Proverbs says this. This is crazy. This doesn't happen. And or like, you believe in a God that would allow this to happen? Look, you say good God, all-powerful God, but look at all these wicked things. That's exactly what Ecclesiastes is doing. He's not, the Christian life, well, let's see, let me do this. This is a quote that kind of wraps up what I'm thinking as far as how the wisdom literature and really scripture as a whole is working. So the most challenging difference between the wisdom books arises when one author doubts, or perhaps you could say Qohelet doubts, questions the validity of basic affirmations of other parts, like Proverbs, of the Bible. But this is precisely the purpose of these books in the collection of scripture. To compel us toward an honest faith that is willing to acknowledge the presence of doubts we cannot dismiss or questions we can't always fully answer given our human limitations. So the wisdom books work together to present, yeah, life is complex. Yeah, life is difficult. It's not always black and white. It's not always fair. It's not always right. So what do you do? How do you live? Do you run away from God? Toward more hevel? Like, you can't escape the hevel no matter how you live, which is part of why he says later on, it's better if you were never born so you never had to experience hevel. So that's kind of how the wisdom literature is working. So Ecclesiastes, what you kind of begin to see is that Ecclesiastes is actually addressing your expectations. You realize that you're expecting something when you don't get it. So when you don't get what you expected out of God or life, you realize your expectations were different, perhaps, than they ever should have been. Or God isn't doing what he should be doing. One of those two. It's either or. So one of the purposes of Ecclesiastes is to adjust our expectations of life and how God is involved in it. What if God's promise to you in this broken world, in this life under the sun, is not, I'm coming into your life to make everything better, to fix all your problems, and to make all your dreams come true? Which honestly is sometimes how idealists would like, or optimists at times would like things to be. I do that. But Ecclesiastes comes in and says, no, actually, God is addressing the problem a very different way. And of course, this is pre-Jesus, but as you look at it now, from our perspective looking back, you say, oh, wow, so Jesus actually entered the hevel. Jesus actually entered the brokenness to begin making it straight again. So that's kind of the process of redemption being accomplished in Christ. Maybe that is his purpose. That's his promise. So until then, Ecclesiastes is saying, have faith and obey, because eventually God's purpose will be worked out. So I just wanted to kind of review and bring us back to that point this morning. So now what we're going to do today, one more week of introduction before we jump into the text. What we're going to do today is we're going to look at the structure of the book. Because again, as I mentioned last week, this is a difficult book to start at the very beginning and just like inch your way through without a little bit of an understanding of what's going on in the whole thing. Because otherwise, we're like with Hevel, right? You may not understand what Hevel means until the very end of the book, or as you're sorting it out as you work through it. And by that point, you've already worked through a significant portion of the book that you need to go back and work through again. So we're going to look at the structure, but we're going to do it together. So you're going to figure out the structure. We're going to figure it out at the same time rather than me just giving it to you. Now, there's a couple things to understand, and I'm not going to do what I did last week on authorship. I'm learning a lesson. I'm not just going to explain all the maybe, I didn't even come close to addressing all of it, but it's not as interesting if you're not engaged in it. So just know this, that the structure of the book is also one of the most highly debated things. Like, people are saying there's three sections, four, five plus, for all these various different reasons. Some people say there is no structure. He's intentionally vague and confusing, and you're not supposed to know how it's going. And that's Hevel, right? The structure is Hevel. So just know that it's debated. So, but what we're going to do is come up with a guy named Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. He has proposed the structure that I'm going to help us uncover this morning. And I think it's, from my study, at least to this point, the fairest, most accurate, helpful structure that there is. So what we're going to do is I'm going to, like I said last week, colors are good. Colors are fun. Colors are helpful. If you're willing or want to, I have tons of pens and colored pencils. If you could grab maybe like three or four of them, if you're willing to write in your Bibles or in these journals that I have. These, we just ordered this last week. They are $5. If anybody wants these, actually now would be a great time. You obviously don't have to have $5 on you. Just toss it in the book at the back. Would anyone be interested in getting one of these? I mentioned them and then forgot to. Okay. Oh boy. We'll see. Did you, somebody here? $5. Three, four, five. Okay, I may get some more. More people want them, we'll get more. And then you too. There we go. Okay. Okay, I just ran out, so we'll get some more next week. I should have gotten some more. That's fine if you don't mind. Yeah. Would you mind just passing it back up? Okay. So feel free. Sometimes one of the scariest things about like kind of underlining or coloring something in your Bible is that you're not sure if you're going to want it there long term. Like when you're studying something, you're like, okay, well, this is cool. But then later on, as you understand a little bit more about it, you're like, okay, I wish I had done it this way. And you're kind of frustrated and it's Hevel anyways, right? So just know that at least I can tell you the things that we're going to point out today are primary things. These are big themes throughout Ecclesiastes. So if you want your Ecclesiastes marked up, these are good things. These are good things to mark up. So what we're going to do is we're going to split the room right here. I think it's actually about 50-50 with this side and then these two sections. So this section, I want you guys to look through chapters 1-6, the first half of the book. And you can, I mean, if you want to reorganize and talk in groups, you can. If you just want to sit there and read it through, that's fine, you can. And then this section, you're going to take 7-12. And what we're looking for is we're going to look for key words or key phrases that you're seeing just like repeated consistently, or perhaps occasionally that seem to break it into sections. So things like what we looked at last week, I mean, Hevel or vanity as it may be translated, is you're going to see that 38 times throughout the book. So that's a whole bunch of times in 12 chapters, and it's a primary theme. But there's a lot more than just vanity. There's a lot more than just Hevel in the book. So we're going to give you maybe about 5 minutes or so, maybe a few more minutes, 7 minutes, because you're working through about 6 chapters each. So I know that's significant. But we're going to let you guys look through, see if you can find some patterns, some key words, key phrases, and begin to interact with the book, begin to read, begin to look, begin to have questions. So go. If you have any questions, feel free to just raise your hand. Actually, I'm going to say one more thing to give you a little bit of help. So remember last week, we did talk about one structural thing. We talked about the introduction and the conclusion, right? That especially with the pronouns that the author's using, it's like there's bookends to the actual words of Qohelet. He starts out, he says, the preacher says this, 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 and then he actually moves to first person pronouns. And then at the end, again, he's going to move to this is what the preacher says. So know that it's up on the screen. There's Hevel and then a poem in 1 through 11, and that's kind of an introductory phrase. So you don't need to look there, chapters 1 through 6. And then at the end, there's a poem and then Hevel in 7:11 through 12:8, and then the postscript at the very end. So just know that you don't need to look through those sections particularly. Look in all the middle section and see how the middle may be divvied up. Okay, that should be good. All right, so let's start with chapters 1 through 6. What are some things that you're seeing? What are and 7 through 12, just kind of, you can begin looking through 1 through 6 and kind of see what we're finding here, and then we'll do vice versa with your section. So 1 through 6, what are some of the themes, repetitive words or phrases that may have something to do with at least the theme, if not the structure of the book? It's all right. You don't have to be right. You can just... Okay, toil. Toil is... We'll talk more about that one later, but toil is used 35 times in the book. So nearly as much as Hevel. And I guess just for illustration, 7 through 12, did you guys see toil as a theme? Nobody did. There's a reason for that. Because it's not a theme in 7 through 12. 30 out of the 35 times are used in 1 through 6, okay? So toil, we'll continue working through, but toil is going to be a sub-theme. It's like the secondary theme of chapters 1 through 6, okay? Time, good. Time, if not in its word, at least is used in its theme very often. So we're going to call that more of a theme of the book as a whole, because again, we're talking about Hevel, and even Hevel may have something to do with time. So absolutely, that's a good one. Wisdom, certainly. I'm sure probably 7 through 12 probably saw wisdom as a theme, because that's going to be drawn out more in the second half of the book. He's going to push more on, okay, so what is wisdom, but how should we use wisdom in a broken world? A lot more in the second half of the book. But wisdom, certainly, again, we're going to go with theme throughout the whole thing. Striving after the wind. Futility, which is going to go back to the Hevel, right? That would be how Hevel's translated in the translation that you're reading. So Leanna said striving after the wind. Did anyone else in 1 through 6 see striving after the wind? Maybe one or two. So that, where do you see that, Leanna? A lot in chapter 2. Okay, this is where it's going to get pretty cool. Okay, so if you want to use a color, striving after the wind is a color you should use. So look in chapter 1, and this is everybody, chapter 1, verse 14. Here's the first usage of it. And this is right at the beginning after our introduction, right? I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. So you have the idea of Hevel paired with striving after the wind. Okay, so you want to underline or highlight striving after the wind there. Verse 17 of chapter 1. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after the wind. Not paired with vanity there, which is important, because the structural marker, what we're going to argue in a minute, is that the structural marker is vanity and striving after the wind paired together. But strive after the wind there, you can highlight that. Yep. In 1:17. So, yes. Starting in verse 18, for in for in much wisdom is vexation as well. So several times throughout Ecclesiastes, he pairs vanity with other attributes. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, that's what you're saying. Okay. Yeah, so let's, okay, good. Thank you. So let's talk about what striving after the wind actually means. No, that's good. That's fine. It's good to be aware of what various translations are saying, so I appreciate that. For the sake of the recording, the King James uses vexation of spirit instead of a striving after the wind. So we have two words, essentially, is what's going on, is we have the word striving and we have wind. So they're saying vexation, spirit, wind, spirit, striving, vexation. So probably my favorite way of saying this is striving it's a beautiful word picture in Hebrew. It's the word for shepherd. It's shepherding is what's happening. So imagine trying to shepherd wind. Corral it, make it go where you want it to go. Keep it all in a group. It doesn't work. That would be a very frustrating thing if your job was to shepherd the wind. So that's the word picture of what he's saying. Yeah. Right. So King James may almost be saying the result of it is that your spirit is vexed. And it is within the semantic range of the word. So like just like hand can mean your literal hand, perhaps your hand in a deck of cards, or it could mean like a verb, hand me that. So spirit is just as well translated, or shepherding the wind. Wind and spirit are in the same semantic range. This word can mean both of those things. So it's not an inappropriate translation. I'm going to say I don't know that I think it's the best translation. I think even striving after the wind, I don't think captures the word picture. I think when we think, especially as the Hebrews in their culture thought, shepherd the wind, they're an agrarian society, and they do this as well. They're used to farming. They're used to doing animals. They're used to all of these things, and so that would have been a really crisp, clear picture to them that like that would be a frustrating impossibility, and that's kind of what he's getting at by the striving after the wind. Okay, thank you, Don, for bringing that up. So that's 1:14, or let's see, 1:14, and then 1:17. Now flip over to chapter 2, and you'll see it again with vanity and striving after the wind in verse 11. So then I considered, verse 11, all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So you have it used a third time there. You can underline, highlight that. Look down later on in chapter 2, verse 17. So I hated life because of what is done under the sun, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and to striving after the wind. Highlight that. The end of chapter 2, verse 26. For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he has given the business of gathering and scattering, or gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Then look in chapter 4, verse 4. Chapter 4, verse 4. Then I saw all the toil and all skill and work came from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Verse 6, you have striving after the wind again by itself, but not with connected with vanity. So you can highlight those. 4 and 6, striving after the wind. Then look at the end of chapter 4, verse 16. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led, yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and a striving after the wind. And then the final time, look in chapter 6, verse 9. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. Chapters 7 through 12, did you see this as a theme as well? Striving after the wind. Nobody's even looking at me. They're like, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. Then you shouldn't have, because it's only used in 1 through 6. As soon as he finishes the final, this also is vanity and a striving after the wind, in chapter 6, verse 9, it's never used again. And there's a hard break right after chapter 6, verse 9. He starts out with completely new information. It's not completely new. It's still thematic. He starts out with more questions in 10 through 12, particularly in verse 12, for who knows what is good for a man to live, or for a man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow. So then he's going to go and kind of in transition. So there's a hard break because this vanity and striving after the wind together is never used again, and striving after the wind is never mentioned again. So that's one significant reason I would propose that that's a good argument for it being a structural break, is that it's only used in the first half, and it's broken up pretty systematically, fairly even sections, fairly new topics after every time that he uses it. So we're going to use that as our primary structural break in the first half of the book, okay, is the vanity and striving after the wind. So after, and we'll see how it kind of, how that fleshes itself out as far as our study goes, but as far as if we'll take one full one of those every time we discuss, I don't know. I don't know if we'll go faster or slower than that, probably not faster. But that's how in the first half it's broken up. And then Leanna mentioned toil. That's really the secondary theme, the underlying theme of this whole thing. If you go back to the beginning of the book in chapter 1, verse 3, he asks this question. He poses a question. He says, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? What's the purpose of all of man's endeavors? And those things are the things that he addresses in the first half of the book. And his conclusion is that their vanity and striving after the wind, all of man's efforts and their toil and their trouble and their work, it's like shepherding wind. Good. Yep. Another major underlying theme is death. And again, so kind of the difference between theme and structure would be that theme is just something you're kind of seeing everywhere, right? You're seeing Hevel, you're seeing time, you're seeing death. Seeing a lot of these wisdom, right? All these things are underlying themes that doesn't necessarily function as breaks, right? Because it's just sort of everywhere. So if every time he used even like time, it was a break, then it'd be sort of all over. It'd just be like bite-sized pieces. So that's part of why both of what we're looking for is theme and structure. Okay, so anything else from 1 through 6? Good. We'll address that more during that section, because he really is posing the question. Again, if you go back to the question, what's the purpose of all of man's toil at which he toils under the sun? Is there any benefit to it? Is there any profit to it? That's one of the main, that's another one of the themes, is the word yatron. It's profit. What's the benefit? Is it good? Do you get anything from it? and so, of whose? Of man's toiling, right? So that is a huge theme. This is an anthrocentric book, right? It's about like us living here. And so he's explaining, I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this, I did that. And then he reaches his conclusion. So that's a great observation. Okay, we have about 5 minutes. So let's move to 7 through 12. What? Yours is harder. Yours is trickier. I'll be impressed. You catch the theme because it's difficult. What are some of the things that you see repeated throughout 7 through 12? Dwight? Death and mourning. Okay, so again, we have the same, there's underlying themes that death is going to happen to everyone and it's going to happen fast. Okay, good. Maybe because the poem at the end is all about death. It's all about aging. So he kind of concludes, his poem at the beginning is all about, was probably what we'll look at next week, is all about the, again, cyclicity of life. And he says at the beginning, a generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. And he talks about the earth's systems and how it just continues going and going and going. And then the poem at the end is all about, yeah, it's all about growing old and dying. So yes, probably a little bit more second half. Yeah. That's a great theme. Yes. So it's he begins comparing things. Because once he's sort of exhausted in the first half, all of man's efforts, and he reaches the conclusion that they're like shepherding the wind. So then we're left with, okay, well then how do we live? How should we go about walking in a broken world? And so he starts saying a little bit proverbial. He kind of goes back in some sections to sound sort of like Proverbs and saying, well, it is better to do this than this. It is better to do this than this. So wisdom is better than folly. And he gives reasons why. But don't forget, wisdom's broken. Wisdom won't answer all your problems, right? Okay, so that's great. That's a good theme, yeah. Good, good. Avoid extremes. Don't be too wise. Don't be too stupid either. But don't be too wise because it's not going to solve your problem. So why chase it down? Okay, just for the sake of time, look at the beginning again, chapter six, starting in verse 12, right after the hard break. Okay, so he's posed the question at the beginning, what's the profit of human endeavor? And he goes through and works through answering that question. Now he poses a new question for the second half of the book. He says, for who knows what is good for a man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? Who can tell man what will be after him? It's a question of how do you know? How do you find out? How are you certain? And so look, there's kind of the information from the first one. So in 7 through 12, I want you to see two different themes. One is who can find or not find, and then who can know or not know. So look in chapter 7, in verse 14. I would suggest that this is going to be our systematic breakdown. Because again, this stuff is not used at all in the first half. Okay. So chapter 7, verse 14. In the days of prosperity and in the days of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other so that, underline this, man may not find out anything that will be after him. Break. Verse 24. That which has been is far off and very, very deep. Who can find it out? Underline that. Throughout the next section, there's several I finds, I founds, or find. And then in verse 28, which my soul has sought repeatedly, but, underline, I have not found. One man among a thousand I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. See, this alone I found, that God has made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. Chapter 8, at the end. So there's a hard break at the end of chapter 7. Now there's going to be a break at the end of chapter 8, because if you look in verse 17, Then I saw all the work of God that man cannot find out. The work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. Then he transitions from finding to knowing in 9 and 10 and 11. So 9:1, second half of the verse. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. You can underline that. Man does not know. Both are before him. Or at the end of middle of chapter 9, verse 12, for man does not know his time. Underline, man does not know. 9:12. Then in chapter 10, verse 14, a fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be. And who can tell him what will be after him? The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. Break. And then chapter 11, our final one. Verse 2, 11:2. Give a portion to 7 or to 8, for you know not what disaster may happen on the earth. Verse 5, as you do not know the way the spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. In the morning, sow your seed, and in the evening, withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. And that takes us right up to 11:7, the poem of life and death, and then the postscript. So the second question being posed is about what we can know. How should we live? What should we do in these few days that we have on earth? How do you figure out the answers to life? And then systematically, breaking into various sections, Kohelet says, man cannot find it out. Man cannot know. You're not allowed the answers by God. So that's kind of how the second one is broken up, is the inability of man to get the answer they want, to the question they're posing, at least. Hopefully that was a helpful start, at least. Now you've read through a little bit more of the book now. You're kind of seeing perhaps some of the bigger arguments, the bigger themes, the structure of how he's working through a question that he poses. With various, okay, it's striving after the wind, striving after the wind, striving after the wind. And then a question he poses. Man cannot find out, man cannot find out. Man does not know, man does not know. Bookended by poem and pebble. And then a postscript at the end. So that's the structure we're going to pursue. I think it's helpful. I think it's consistent. I think it's Hebrew. It's Kohelet. It's not simply by themes, but by the literature as well. So that's how we're going to start next week, is working through Hevel and a poem, and then we'll begin through after that. Let's pray.